some business. Next week is spring break, so we will not be meeting next week. Class is canceled on Thursday. We'll not have class on Thursday. So this is the last class, at least here, for before spring break. So have a good spring break. That's it for me. Any questions? Your first programming assignment is due, I don't know when. Is it 6 o'clock or something? Your second programming assignment is out. I will have more to say about your second programming assignment on the other side of spring break, which actually, I guess, is like the last week, I think.
Did you write that I made a package, just an empty package that had nothing in it, just to get that overview tour?
Yes, that's really irritating. Yeah, I mean, that's what you had to do. I don't know why they don't show the overview if you just have one package, but I guess maybe the assumption is then the package description is the overview. So, but yeah, that, yeah, just submitting an empty package directive will be fine. Any other questions? One thing I will say about assignment two, I'd like people to work in pairs, and one person in the pair should be from 305, the other person in the pair should be from 306. That's the only constraint I'll put on it. So you might want to think about that. Today we're not going to talk about anything because, oh, there we go. Today we're going to talk about exceptions, which is, in general, a questionable idea. We'll talk about why exceptions are around. It's a really difficult topic, I think. They're a fairly old concept. They've been in programming languages for quite a while. They're in PL1, for example. And I suppose you could argue to a certain extent PL1 sort of set the standard for exceptions, which hasn't really been met in every programming language since. But that's a separate issue. And then, of course, there's the Java implementation of exceptions, which brings its own difficulties into it. So this is actually going to be a difficult, or at least I hope it's not a difficult lecture, but it's a lecture about a difficult topic. And I will point out the sorts of, and it's also, to a certain extent, controversial, too, largely because people don't really know how to deal with exceptions. No one's really come up with a fairly clean way of dealing with the issues that exceptions deal with and then dealing with exceptions themselves. I'll motivate this by talking about the error problem. In C++, it's a lot clearer why it is you really need to have exceptions. If you take exceptions out, there are significant things that you cannot do in C++. There's a similar issue for Java, but it's not quite as significant because there are less occurrences of the need for exceptions in Java than there are in C++. Then we will talk about exception basics, which will lean heavily on your knowledge of what you learned in C++. To a certain extent, they are the same. We'll talk about then the exception hierarchy, which is a lot more tricky than it is in C++. And in particular, the difficult notion of checked versus unchecked exceptions. And then we'll continue on and talk about some refinements to this. The idea, we're introducing a new feature into the language, and now we have to figure out, okay, how does it relate to all the other old features, in particular inheritance, since we'll see exceptions are associated fairly closely with methods. So now we have to worry about, well, what about inheritance? What about overriding? What about, what's the other one? Overloading. You have to think about all those issues, too. The error problem. What happens if there's an error in a constructor? Constructors can do pretty complicated things. They can go out to a database. They can try and read files, read images from files. A lot of things could happen, go wrong in a constructor. What happens when that occurs? What's the problem? Why is that something that you can't deal with as you can deal with it in any other occurrence? For example, if it happens in a method, what happens if you try and read a file in a method and it's not there? Well, whatever you do in a method, why can't you do it in the constructor? That's your cue. You give me an answer.
The object doesn't get created.
That's true, but suppose that you wanted to indicate that something went wrong. What does that mean to the person who said, "Give me a blob"? and I can't give you a blob, but what do? How do I handle that? Right, the problem is, and the reason that this is a different context than it is for methods, is there's really no way to indicate, to give feedback. Well, actually, we'll see that there is. But in general, giving information back to the caller of the constructor is more constrained than it is with respect to methods. In particular, there's no, you can't put a return statement in a blob. Right, so you can't control what it is you return, so you have to rely on other things. What happens if something goes wrong way down there? You call a library, and as you, I suspect, are beginning to appreciate, there's a lot of libraries in Java, and they're nested. So you can go down several layers deep into a library. What happens if something blows up down there? This is the principal difficulty with dealing with this issue. I make a call up here, and I go down through several layers of library, and all of a sudden something blows up down there. And the problem here, of course, is that you have two widely varying contexts. I have this very high-level abstract context that I initiated the call in, and then there's this extremely low-level context in which something went wrong. How do you handle that? What's supposed to happen there? That's the problem. And, of course, in C++, let's not talk about that, because we have a lot to talk about today. Both of those issues, the constructor error and the error deep down in the library, you can think of as being instances of the error pass-along problem. You incur an error in one location, and you need to pass along information to wherever it was that invoked that operation to give them the opportunity to deal with that error in ways that they see fit. The code at the error source may not be able to handle the error, particularly if it's related to something that it knows nothing about. And this is the context problem. The code very down deep, or the code within a constructor, does not know the context in which it was invoked. So it really has no particularly good way of approaching the solution to this problem. Certainly, if you look for a file and it's not there, the library can handle it itself by saying, oops, file's not here, and blow up. Now, that's, generally speaking, not going to be an appropriate solution, because what you might want to do is go back to the person who called you, or go back to the entity that called you and said, file's not here, and let them handle it. They may want to blow up, or they may want to say, okay, try this file instead. Understanding the context around which you should solve this error or deal with this error turns out to be a difficult problem. Putting an error message and dying tends to be helpful, usually in development, but not always. Generally speaking, don't want to have that happen in production code, although I would argue that you do. The other alternative, if you're not going to handle the error, is to just give up. So you clean up locally, you just tidy yourself up, and then pass along the error back to the entity that called you. Now, that's a better approach because it's localized. I know when something goes wrong specifically with respect to, for example, file lookup, and that fails, locally I know how to clean up after myself. I may not know how to handle the consequences of not finding that file more generally, but at least with respect to the local procedure or method, I know how to handle that. So you just handle it, and then you just call back, you just return back to whatever called you saying, file's not here, and let it go up the line. That's a better approach, but how do you do that? What's the best way to do that? And we saw that there are some problems in answering that question, in particular with the constructors. Certainly, the one obvious way to do it is to use error returns. Methods can return error status values. For example, you can call some method, and it returns some error status, and you can check the error status, and if it's okay, you can go on. If it's file not found, you can do something else. Right, that's a pretty straightforward approach. The problem here is that it complicates error returning methods. In Java, you can only return a single value, a reference to an instance, a class instance, or a primitive value. Which doesn't mean that you can't return multiple values, but you have to create a special class. Again, it's like you've got 3 feet of insulation in order to get the job done, and you really shouldn't have to have that much. So it complicates the value returning methods, and constructors can't return any values. As we indicated earlier, if there's a problem in a constructor, you just can't return a value because you don't have a return statements in constructors. So This is an okay approach, although currently a lot of people don't like it. The other possibility is that you can have error parameters. You pass error values through method parameters. So you call a method, it accepts a bunch of arguments, and one of those arguments is some sort of error indicator. So you call the method and you pass in a reference to this instance of this error, and then when you return from the method, you check the status and see if it's okay. If it's not, you go deal with it. The problem here is that this is not object pure. Essentially, what you have is a record. You have a field called status, which you check and set. Now, of course, you can deal with that by using getters and setters, but that's just, that's sort of a pointless veneer over just having a record with a field hanging out in the breeze. On the other hand, this does work for constructors. You can pass in a error value and have the inside of the constructor change that value based on whether it can find a file or make a database connection. On the other hand, this also inherits the same problems that the error return does. In particular, people object to having to litter their code with checks for error status, particularly every time you call a method. But this is a reasonable approach. Within the context of Java, that is. Third possibility is to use error globals. You have some global value someplace, and you just set that whenever there's an error in return. This is the Unix way, right? That's ERNO, the global variable ERNO. This is not particularly well structured. It's kind of difficult to do in Java because you need a class that has a static field, so that would essentially represent your error value. And it's certainly not thread safe. So from that point of view, it's probably an extremely bad thing to do. The solution that people have come up with over the years or have added to their language to deal with this issue are exceptions. Exceptions provide an alternative mechanism for delivering error indicators. And that's actually an important phrase, the alternative mechanism. It is completely alternative from the standard mechanisms that you're used to in programming languages. That's one of the difficulties about exceptions. Exceptions are not propagated along parameters, return values, or globals. This is the reason they're handy, because each one of these has problems. Some of these you can't use in constructors. Other of them, like parameters or globals, it's extremely difficult, or people find it to be extremely difficult to use well. This style of communication is known as out-of-band communication. You are essentially going out of band, and we'll talk about what the band is in a couple of minutes. But this style of communication through exceptions is known as out-of-band communication. The nice thing about out-of-band communication, because it doesn't go along the normal channels, is code that is not interested in the exceptions can ignore them, and essentially ignore them with no effort. They don't have to do anything, which is good, because if you have something up here that understands how to deal with the error, and then you have something down here which causes the error, what you've got in between is a whole bunch of stuff that doesn't either know or care. And you're going to have to cater to those in-between layers that are willing to ignore the whole issue. Unfortunately, as we'll see, it's not quite that simple. They can't really ignore it, even with exceptions. The basics, we're going to talk, it seems like every class I teach, regardless of what it is, we talk about call stacks, and we're going to talk about call stacks now. Each method call has a stack frame, which is the place that you store things like variables, parameters, kinds of internal things. The call stack contains the stack frames of all current method calls. I talked about this in 306, and I also talked about it in 305. We're going to talk about it again. Oops, I see it's a little big. Let's see if we can't make it smaller. There we go. When one method calls another, the called method pushes its stack frame on the stack. This is why I talk about it in 305, because, as I said, the call stack gives you a free stack, so you don't have to implement your own. When the top method returns, it pops its call stack frame off the call stack and so forth and so on. Here's an example. I have a main that calls ci.f. In F, it calls ci.g, and in G, it calls possibly recursively itself if there's some guard that's true. Initially, your program calls main, which pushes, or something, the operating system calls main, which pushes main stack frame, and then main calls F, which pushes F stack frame on top of main. F then calls G, which pushes G stack frame on top of F, and then perhaps G calls itself a few times, and each time that G calls itself, it pushes another stack frame for G on the stack. I've only shown one here, but it can go up. As long as B is true, it'll keep pushing stack frames. But eventually, G returns and pops its own stack frame off the call stack, which gives control back to F. In other words, the call to G returns, then F executes some more, and eventually the call to F returns, and then we're a main, and then eventually main returns, and you're out and done. All right. Everyone should be familiar with this. I hope I'm not surprising anybody or blowing anybody's mind with this. This, by the way, is the in-band communication. Parameters go this way, and then return values, or I should say input parameters go this way, return values and output parameters go this way. So this is the in-band form of communication. Global variables, of course, are down here someplace. Now, what is the relationship between exceptions and the call stack? The top of the call stack can throw an exception. Why is that, just offhand? Why is it the top of the call stack? Why can't you throw an exception from the middle of the call stack? Access to what?
The middle of the stack.
What do you mean by access? I mean, that's sort of a right answer, but you have to.
The only elements that you can see on
the stack are the items. Oh, I see what you're saying. So yeah, all right. So you're taking the traditional view of the stack. Okay. So how can I ask the question? All right, that's true. That's correct. Is there any other reason why it might be the case that you can only throw exceptions from the top of the stack?
Isn't the top the only part that's being worked on?
Exactly. The only part that's actually that's executing is the top of the stack. All these other stack frames beneath the top are dormant. They're not doing anything. So your answer was right, but the way you can think about it is thread of execution. Here we're talking about a singly threaded program, and the thread of execution is always going to be in the top stack frame. So there's no threads of execution lower than the top stack frame to actually throw anything. Now, of course, if we had a multi-threaded program, that wouldn't be true, but if we had a multi-threaded program, then we wouldn't have just a single stack frame. The top of the call stack can throw an exception. This terminates the throwing method, popping it from the call stack. Each new call stack top has a choice at this point. It can either catch the exception or let it pass. All right, so here's where the communication comes in. Catching the exception continues execution at the catching method. So the method that actually catches the exception, execution will continue from there. Letting the exception pass terminates the method, popping it from the call stack. Here's an example. I have, in this case, a call stack with four stack frames, and H decides to throw an exception. So it throws the exception, E, and it terminates. It's gone. Now, G is at the top of the call stack, and it has a decision. It can either catch E or let it go by. In this example, it decides to let it go by, in which case G terminates. Pop the call stack. Now, F has the same decision. Should it catch E or let it go by? In this case, it decides to catch it. So it catches the exception, which brings it into the execution environment for F, and then F continues execution. If F had decided to let the exception go by, then you would pop F off the call stack and give main the choice. And if main decided to let it go by, you would pop main off, and then that's it. You'd be done. Presumably, the operating system would give you some sort of error indication that you have an uncaught exception that propagated all the way back and essentially killed the entire stack frame. This idea of popping the call stack because of an exception is known as unwinding the call stack. completely unwinding the call stack, as I just indicated, terminates the program. Now you can see why I call this out-of-band communication. Because essentially, I mean, the way I like to think of it is each one of these little stacked frames has a window in it. And when one stack frame, when one method calls another, then the little thread associated with this particular method just goes to the window and looks out, gazing over the landscape. And occasionally, an exception will come screaming by, and at that point, it has a choice. It can reach out and catch the exception, or it can let the exception continue to fall, in which case, if it lets it fall, it terminates. But the idea is we're going out of band. We are not going along the normal parameter return value mechanisms or global mechanisms. Now, as you might expect, to implement this, you actually go down the stack because you have a bunch of pointers indicating where the exception handlers are for each stack frame. So this is, in fact, all done along the stack, but conceptually, anyway, it's separate from the stack, which is why it's out of band. That's the mechanism that allows us to deal with constructors. All right, so that's the basic operation behind exceptions, basic implementation, too. Any questions about that? It's good to understand that because that will help you understand some of the properties of exceptions that we're going to be talking about in the rest of this lecture. Exceptions are completely different from everything else because of this sort of out-of-band style of communication, which first of all gives you another new and different thing to watch. And this is completely different. The control is different. The data transfer is different. The semantics are different. Everything is different. Coordinated exceptions among independent modules requires work. Because it's out of band, you don't have the normal channels of communication. Which means that if you want to understand the relationship between independent modules and exceptions, you can't use your normal techniques. You can't trace, for example, you can't trace the call tree, for example. Although exceptions do follow the call tree. Which methods throw what exceptions when? These are the kinds of questions that you have to answer in order to be able to deal with this issue. And again, it's not really obvious how that works. Unwinding the call stack is violent. When an exception propagates to a stack frame, the decision to either handle or pass that exception must be made at that point. And if the decision is to pass, that stack frame terminates. Right? It may occur, and that may occur unexpectedly, because you don't know exactly what set of exceptions are being thrown, and the consequences of that are severe. Essentially, execution stops for that stack frame. If you have resources hanging around, you have to make sure they get cleaned up. This is more of a problem in C++, which has sort of wild and woolly resource management, than it is for other programming languages like Java, which has a more mannered way of dealing with resources. All right, that's the sort of basic theory of exceptions. Any questions about that? Should not be surprising from previous experience. How many people have experience with exceptions other than C++? Have you used other languages?
Yeah, I did Java a few, like just a little bit.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? The exceptions in Java, there are essentially three components for dealing with them. There's the throw statement, there's the try block, and the catch block. There are other components. For example, there's the exceptions itself, the exceptions themselves. There's the throws clause in the method declaration and so forth. We'll talk about those. But I mentioned these three because those are the basic statements that you use to deal with exceptions. And they should be familiar from your C++ experience. The throw statement. The throw statement signals or throws or raises or launches an exception. Very simple. You throw an exception reference. It's like return in syntax and semantics. You can put parentheses around it if it makes you feel better. But essentially what it does is it terminates the execution of the method that calls it, and it returns the value that is passed as the argument to the throws. It doesn't happen along the normal return value route, as I just illustrated. But otherwise, it's like return. It's also not optional. You have to throw something if you are going to throw. Here's an example of just throwing a null pointer exception. An alternative is to declare a reference to a null pointer exception and then throw that. Either one is fine. There's no particular advantage to doing this. The catch block is responsible for catching thrown exceptions. It is, you can think of this as being kind of a, like a method. I think Horstman recognizes that and says, oh, you know, it kind of looks like a method, right? Except that the name of the method is called catch. And it has a single parameter, which is the exception that you want to catch. And then you have a body, which when you call this catch method, you execute. The syntax is similar to a one-parameter method definition, so it looks like this. The exception name is accessible only within the catch body, so this is like the scope of a formal parameter in a method. The try block is the place within which you check for exceptions. An exception can be caught only when it's thrown from within a try block. This is the tricky part about using exceptions. Try block is really simple. It's just a compound statement preceded by the keyword try. An exception thrown outside a try block immediately unwinds that method. So if you call a method and you don't call it from within a try block, you don't even get the choice of determining whether or not you want to catch that exception if a procedure or a method in the method that's been called throws one. You just immediately terminate, which is another example of the violence of unwinding the call stack. A try block is its own scope, which is a pain because I usually make, I'll show you the obvious mistake I always make. Variables declared in the try block are inaccessible outside it. That's an indication of the mistake I usually make. What you do is you put try and catch statements together. A try block and one or more catch blocks form what's known as a try-catch statement. So we take our try block, in which we execute things that may throw exceptions, and then we append to that one or more catch clauses, which if exceptions are thrown in that try block, try and catch. And this is the basic exception handling unit. So this is what your code looks like when you are dealing with exception handling. Now the claim is, people's claim is, this is better looking code, this is smaller code, this is easier to read code, than code that looks like this. Because that's what you have to do for, if you're passing explicit error status around, you have to put these checks in here. So this is my first disagreement with exceptions. In my opinion, this is much easier to deal with than this. You don't have scopes to worry about. You don't have this fairly complex semantics to worry about. This is a complex issue here. Furthermore, this is extremely cumbersome when you're dealing with fine-grained error detection and recovery. As a consequence, generally speaking, exception handling tends to be very coarse-grained. People don't want to put too many of these things in a single method. They generally try and only have one, which means that you have to have small methods, which is a good idea, or you have to lump everything into a fairly complex try-catch statement. On the other hand, it's fairly easy to abstract error checking from returning status values. It's fairly difficult to do to extract try-catch or exception handling because of the need to deal with try-catches. The normal flow of control through a try-catch block, I have a bunch of statements preceding my try-catch statement. So I execute the last statement before the try-catch block, and if that doesn't throw an exception, then we proceed into the body of the try clause and execute the statements one after the other, or based on whatever the control flow is for the statements. This can be just general purpose code, like you would put outside in a method body. If none of these statements throw an exception, then you'll hit the end. Well, not necessarily eventually, you could have an infinite loop, but let's assume that eventually you'll hit the last statement in the try clause. And when you do that, you'll just pass out to the next statement. So that's normal execution. Nothing happens. No exceptions get thrown. Execution resumes with the statement following the try-catch block. The catch blocks in this case, because nothing is thrown, are ignored. They just get skipped. And we're actually going to make this more complicated later on in the lecture, but for now, this is pretty straightforward. also looks a lot like what you would expect to see in C++. All right, this is normal behavior. Questions about that? Jumping from the try block to the catch block occurs on an exception. The only way to get into this set of catch clauses is if some statement in the try body or the try clause throws an exception. The transfer is immediate. Now, what did I mean there? Jump from the try block to the catch block on an exception. Immediate, but normal try blocks go. Oh, I see what you're saying. The transfer is immediate. In other words, it's not like you pass through the bottom of the try block and then go to the catch block. You exit immediately from the try clause. But that is if you had done a normal scope exit, which means that any resources that you declare go out of scope. All right, that's the point there. Search, which of course means that if you have any resources that need to be cleaned up in the catch clauses, then they shouldn't be in the body of the try clauses because they're going to be gone when you hit the catch clauses. Once you exit from the try block, then you start searching for matching catch blocks in the order that they are listed following the try clause. An exception is considered handled as soon as you find a match between the exception that was thrown and the exception that the clause is looking for. After executing the associated catch body, then you continue after the try-catch statement, assuming the catch body exits normally. We'll talk about what happens when you throw exceptions, when you're handling exceptions, in a couple of minutes. Here's an example of that. I have statements executing before, then I reach the try block, so I jump in and start executing these statements one after the other, or whatever the control structure of the try clause body is. But one of those statements throws an exception. We exit the try block immediately from that statement, recover the resources that were allocated in the try block, and then go down the list of catch clauses trying to find a match to the exception that was thrown. Eventually, we hit one. In this example, we hit one. So we find a match to that exception thrown. Then we execute the body of the catch clause and then continue execution after the at the statement after the try-catch block. Or try-catch, at this point it's a statement, try-catch statement. Again, this assumes that the body of the catch clause does not throw another exception or issues a return statement or does it continue. If this is in a loop, this whole sequence of code here could be in a loop, a while loop or a for loop. And you could have a continue statement here or a break statement, in which case the break statement would take effect and you'd exit the loop. There's a lot of different ways that you can exit this thing, but all of those ways are ways that you would expect to be able to do in just standard code within a method. What happens when an exception gets thrown and none of the catch clauses can deal with it? And we'll talk about what can deal with it means in a couple of minutes. That's what's known as an unhandled exception for that try-catch statement. And if no catch block matches, then that terminates the current method and continues unwinding the stack. So this is the case where this is the other case where the method says, I don't want to catch that exception. I'm going to let it go. When you fail to match that exception to the listed catch blocks. Of course, the first instance of saying that you don't want to catch the exception is when the exception occurs outside a try-catch block. Then you don't have a choice. Then you terminate. So in this case, we do the same thing. We enter into the body. We execute some statements. One of them blows up. We go down to the catch clauses. We follow them one after the other in the order given, doing the match. All the matches fail. At this point, we propagate the exception down the call stack, terminating this particular instance of this method call. All right, so those are the two basic, or I guess three basic things that can happen in exceptions. One of them doesn't get thrown. You don't throw any exceptions. You throw an exception and it gets handled within the particular try-catch statement that caused the exception to be thrown, or an exception gets thrown and it doesn't get handled by that try-catch statement. Now we should look at what happens when you do cleanup. Because generally speaking, what's going to happen is you're going to have your try-catch block is going to like this. You're going to have state set up. You're going to call a method which could possibly throw an exception or not. And then at the end of the try-catch block, you're going to have some state teardown. So you're going to open up a file here. You're going to close a file there. You're going to open up a database connection here. You're going to close it here. The problem with this structure is that the exceptions thrown between state setup and state teardown are essentially going to jump immediately out of the try-catch block. So even though the exit from the try block is orderly in the sense that you go out of scope, you don't execute any code. So in other words, in particular, you don't do state teardown. When exceptions occur, that will in fact interrupt any explicit state management you have in the try-catch block, or in particular in the try block, which suggests that you don't put state management in try blocks. Right? That's the first mistake you have to avoid making. Although it turns out that there are actually features in try-catch statements that will help us deal with that, and we'll come to those in a few minutes. What do we do now? How do we deal with this? How do we handle this? Well, I just gave you one way to handle it, is to move the state management outside. So, for example, we would take this state management setup and put it up here, and then we take this. Well, what happens if we put this state management down here? Does that solve the problem? Okay, why not? Exactly. The problem is if this method or some method in the body throws an exception that these catch statements don't handle, then when you reach the end of this list, you're going to exit. You're not going to get to the state teardown code. So what do we do instead? Exactly. The other possibility is to take the state teardown code and stick it in each one of the catch blocks. Well, that's, of course, an awful solution, because if you decide to, for example, change or add or remove state that you want to manage in the process of dealing with the statement, then you have to go make sure you go through and change all of these. And you can deal with that. I mean, if you're going to do this, you should probably write a method that is state teardown, but still. You have to remember to call that method at the end of every catch block. But notice that might not even work, because you could throw an exception before you get to that method. And now you're back to the same problem you had before. Right, exceptions are really tricky. The alternative way to deal, and of course at this point, I could ask. This is C++, right? This is how C++ works. There's no way to deal with that other than the ways that we've described here. Is that true? Well, actually, you can play games like variable initialization is resource acquisition. You can do things like that. But for the most part, you have this problem in C++. Now, in Java, you don't, because they've added another clause to the try-catch statement, which is known as the finally block. A try-catch statement's finally block is always executed, exception or not, or whether or not the exception is handled. So this is code that always gets executed, independent of whether or not you throw an exception in the try body, and independent of when an exception gets thrown, whether or not that exception is handled. So the alternative way to deal with this state teardown problem is to essentially put that code into the finally block. And then it will always be executed, regardless of how control moves through the try-catch block associated with it. And this is something that you don't have in C++. I believe that's correct. Is that right? Or maybe they added it or something in the most recent revision. I don't think they did, but here are some examples of that. Here's the case when you don't throw an exception. Run through from before the try-catch statement, and you go in and execute the body. No exceptions. You fall out to the finally, execute the body there, and go on to the next statement. Almost the same thing as we had before, except that before hitting the next statement after the try-catch block, you go through the finally body first. If you throw an exception and it gets handled, then you have one of these catch clauses that is executing. You go through the body of that catch clause. We're assuming, again, a normal termination in the body. When the associated catch body terminates, you go down to the finally clause, execute that code, and then fall out the bottom and go on to the next statement. If none of the catch clauses catch that exception, then you go through each one of those, failing, and then you hit finally, you execute that, and then you propagate the exception. There's actually one more that we missed here. What is that? or one more that, how do you like the way I said we? We wrote the lecture notes, so we made a mistake. And what did we do wrong? Exactly. If you throw a exception during handling the catch statement, in that case, the same thing happens. You go to the finally clause, execute that, and then propagate the exception out. Questions about that? I've actually seen people write code that uses finally, even though they're not expecting to get any exceptions. So it would be just a try statement followed by finally. I don't know what the status of that is, whether that's considered good programming or bad. It seems kind of hackish to me, but I don't have the right point of view with respect to exceptions, so it's quite possible. It could be.
Well, aren't there some that you need to set up a try block?
For example?
Aren't there like, I forget where it is exactly, but I was getting errors because I didn't have, I think it was checked and unchecked.
Oh, yes, we'll talk about that, but that's a separate.
But
well,
they might not be expecting an exception, so, but they have to put the syntax in.
Yes, but that would be the throws clause that deals with that. We'll get to checked and unchecked exceptions, and we can come back to that. Any questions about the try-catch-finally statement? Except for the finally part, this should be congruent with your C++ experience. Questions about that? All right, let's go back and talk about this notion of matching exceptions. So you're executing code in a try body, and an exception gets thrown. And then you march through the sequence of catch clauses trying to match the exception thrown to the individual catch clauses. What does that matching mean? What process goes on there? That's what we'll talk about now. Exception matching uses assignment compatibility. No big deal. The catch block with the exception type ET catches an exception of type TET when TET is a descendant of ET. In other words, the exception thrown is type compatible with the exception expected by the clause. And by type compatible, that means then descendant. And this could be proper descendant. So, in fact, TET could be ET itself, the exception type. So the thrown exception type could, in fact, be equal to the exception type, or it could be a proper descendant of the exception type. The first matching exception wins, not the closest. So if you have a if you have an exception clause that has, let's see, now how do you want to do this? You have the parent, you have a clause that expects the parent type, you have a clause that expects the child type, and then you have a clause that expects the grandchild type. Right. And then you throw a grandchild. Well, a grandchild is assignment compatible with the parent type, so that's the exception that that's the exception clause that you're going to take, even though you have an exact match further on. You have a match between the grandchild type and the grandchild type. You're going to take the first match you see. This is just like C++. Which means that you should order the exceptions from the most specific, that is lower in the hierarchy, to the most general, higher in the hierarchy, in the try-catch statements. As a general rule, that's what you want to do. And I believe the compiler will actually tell you, if you give it the lint option, you know, you have an exception that's more general before an exception that's more specific. So you're always going to essentially overshadow the more specific one with the more general one. Here's the exception hierarchy. We start with, of course, object, and a child of object is the throwable, and this is the root of our exception hierarchy. Then from there we have error and exceptions, and they are different. We will talk about why they're different. Then under exceptions you have IO exceptions and runtime exceptions, and then under each one of those you have all kinds of other exceptions. We'll come back to this picture when we go through when we're done talking about all these individual exceptions. This is unfortunately a picture that you have to understand, have it written down someplace so that you can refer to it. The throwable class is at the top of the exception hierarchy. It has constructors that accept a message that indicates what the reason behind throwing this exception. And then it also has something that's known as a, what is it called? I forget what it's called. I actually forgot what the process is called. Let me come back to that. We'll just go through it and talk about it, and then I'll come back to what these throwable parameters are. You also have the expected getters and setters. You can get the message. You can set the message. You can get the clause, throw the clause, and so forth. You can look at the Java API page for more details. There are links on the lecture notes. Everything that you can throw in an exception is going to be a child of throwable, or throwable itself. It's going to be a descendant of throwable. This differs from C++. C++, you can throw any old thing you want. That's one of the fun things about C++. That's not the case of Java. In Java, it has to be a descendant of throwable. The throwable child error defines abnormal conditions, and we'll come back to this. There's a fairly severe epistemological problem when you deal with exceptions, and we'll get into that as we go along. But here's our first indication of the problems we're going to run into. Abnormal conditions. What is an abnormal condition? Well, the expectation is it means something like the end of the world. Internal failures, you know, the disk has caught on fire, the CPU is now crispy, things like that. Applications should ignore error-based exceptions and should not throw them. Again, these things represent absolute end-of-the-world happenings, not the kind of thing you would expect to occur during the execution of your program, nor the kinds of things you would expect your execution to bring about, at least not deliberately, anyway. The point here is that the situation is so bad that there's nothing you can do about it. Right? If the world is ending, then, well, there's not much you can do. Example error children include things like virtual machine error and assertion error. This is something, of course, you have no control over. If the virtual machine decides to go crazy, well, that's it. Game's over. On the other hand, you can plant assertions in your code, as we would have talked about on Thursday if we were going to actually have that lecture. And the failure of an assertion is assumed to be a failure that is essentially unfixable. So that's the kind of occurrences that should cause an exception error to be thrown. I'm sorry, an error exception to be thrown. I got that backwards. Or I suppose I should just say an error to be thrown. Because next up is the exception class. The throwable child exception defines undesirable conditions the application should handle or at least react to. All right, so now we've gone from abnormal to just undesirable. Of course, abnormal things are undesirable, but the point is presumably you're not really in a position, or your program is not in a position to deal with abnormal things, but may in fact be able to deal with undesirable things. Exception is sort of the useful catch-all in a catch block. So this sort of represents the most general kind of exception you would expect to see in a clause, in a set of exception clauses. You shouldn't catch errors, you shouldn't throw them, so you wouldn't expect to see errors, and you shouldn't see throwables, although you could put them in there if you wanted to. Applications should throw leaf exception descendants, and we'll come back to this. This is one of the principles about using exceptions wisely. You should always throw leaf classes that are exceptions. You shouldn't throw parent classes. We'll talk about that later. In addition, you should throw as much information as possible to help recovery. In other words, that message argument in the constructor as well as the cause parameter, the throwable cause parameter. The children of exception, there's essentially two big ones. One is the I/O exception, which defines undesirable conditions related to I/O operations. Examples include file not found exception and end of file exception. The exception child runtime exception defines undesirable conditions related to non-IO execution. That's a terrible line break. Examples of that include things like cast exception and null pointer exception. So you see, things are getting more and more finely divided as we go down the exception hierarchy, and it becomes less and less clear what's causing those bifurcations. See, this is the evil of top-down class design, as opposed to the kind of bottom-up design I've been talking about, where you have a bunch of models and you start to abstract features to combine those into more general issues. Here we're starting at the top with the most general thing and trying to sort of imagine how we might partition things up. That generally doesn't work as well. All right, so let's take a look at our hierarchy again. Throwable is the root of the exception hierarchy. generally speaking, you should not create throwables, and you shouldn't put them in your catch clauses. Errors are should be neither thrown nor caught in your program, because your program can't do anything to handle them and shouldn't do anything to cause them. Exceptions, on the other hand, are the root of the checked exceptions, more or less. We'll come back to that in a minute. And then runtime are the unchecked exceptions. And I've indicated where the checked exceptions. See, this is one of the reasons why exception isn't quite the root, because one of its children is unchecked, but also its parent is checked too. You could say the same thing about throwables, because this error is unchecked. Right, so that's the hierarchy again. And again, unfortunately, you have to become familiar with it. Now we get to go further into epistemology. We can talk about avoidable versus fateful occurrences. This is one of the reasons why it takes forever to design libraries in Java, because you have to, if you're going to define a library, you should pretty much define a set of exceptions that that library can throw, and you have to do these kinds of categorizations to figure out what kind of exceptions they should be. And now you start to get into debates about whether you're dealing with avoidable occurrences or fateful occurrences. And I should say that this is my terminology. Other people have different terminology for these kinds of issues. But an avoidable occurrence is one that could be prevented with a reasonable amount of care. Notice that this is an extremely vague statement, because it's not saying what exactly is the entity that's exhibiting this reasonable amount of care. A good example of an avoidable occurrence is a null pointer reference. Your code should never really have null pointer references. In addition, so is a downcast to a non-ancestor class. These are kinds of mistakes that your code should not actually incur, because they shouldn't do it in the first place. A fateful occurrence cannot reasonably be prevented. There's nothing that you can do to deal with this issue. Writing to a full disk would be an example of a fateful occurrence. Accessing a missing web server. You have no control over a web server exists or not. So if you go out for a particular, like Twitter, for example, and it's not there, there's not much you can do. On the other hand, anybody want to argue that point? This is where the epistemological arguments come in.
Could be your web server.
It could be your web server, but let's assume it's not. Let's assume it's somebody else's. Well, you could just go someplace else, right? If Twitter's down, go to Plurk. If you can't access Google, go to Yahoo. So it's not, again, so at this point you can argue about whether this is a fateful occurrence or an avoidable occurrence. But I don't actually want to get into those issues. As long as you have some indication of the understanding of these things, then that's what I'm trying to get across. Any questions about this? All right, now let me tell you the way I think about these things. Essentially, you can think of your program, I like to think of my program, as a circle. Anything that occurs entirely within the circle is what I consider to be an avoidable occurrence, because you have complete control over that. Right? You wrote the program. So you have control over whether or not you throw a null pointer reference. You have control over whether or not you downcast correctly. Those things are avoidable. So another way to think about this is it's an internal occurrence. It's something that occurs entirely inside your program. You have complete control over it. What's the contrast to that? Exactly. So I've drawn a circle, and has anybody read Laws of Form here? By, I think it's G. Spencer Brown. That was my advisor's revenge on me for all the pain I caused him. He said, oh, you should read this book. It's really good. And it's, you know, it's like 75 pages, and I've been reading it now for 10 years, and I still don't understand it. But essentially what he tries to do is he tries to create all of logic from drawing circles and distinguishing inside from outside. That's essentially what Jansen brought up. What you have is you have your circle. Everything inside is under your control. So everything that touches your circle at the boundary is not in your control. And, of course, you're interacting with the environment. So that's where the fateful occurrences come in. So the disk is full. Well, there's nothing you can do about that, right? Because that's not in your program. The web server's missing. Again, there's nothing you can do about that because that's not inside your program. Now, you can do other things, like you can try a different web server, or maybe you can try a different disk, or, you know, there are other things that you can do. But for the most part, you have to actually worry about the occurrence of these things. These things you shouldn't worry about because you should be able to reach a state in which they can't occur. So another way to think about this is internal occurrences versus external occurrences. And notice also this includes things like libraries, right? If you call the Java Sound Library, you're invoking a huge amount of function there, which you have no control over, and that could throw exceptions. So that's another example of something in the environment, even though it's a little bit more tightly integrated into your program than, for example, accessing a web server. It's the same principle. It's something outside your program that you don't really have control over. So this I find to be a more useful way to think about things, but you can also think about them in terms of avoidable versus fateful. All right, well, what was the point there? Why did I go through all that? Well, the reason I went through that is because now we have to think about how you handle these things. These things will occur. Now we have to think about how to handle them, and that's why the distinction between fateful or avoidable or internal and external can help you. There's no good excuse for encountering an avoidable occurrence. This is something I mentioned when we talked about that. They result from ignorance, indolence, or incompetence. Pick your favorite. My favorite is indolence. There is really no good protection against encountering a fateful occurrence. Right? Protection against fate is costly versus the benefit gained. You have to do a cost-benefit analysis, but in the most part, trying to protect yourself completely from fateful occurrences turns out to be very expensive and doesn't pay off. So at this point, you're doing a cost-benefit analysis. You're saying, well, I suppose the disk is full. How should I handle that? Suppose the web server is not there. Suppose that Twitter is down. Well, how about Plurk? Will that do? Here, of course, you should just apply yourself and say, all right, no null pointer exceptions. There's no reason for me to throw them. That brings us to the idea of checked versus unchecked exceptions. Now we can come back to what Jansen had talked about. Java uses the idea of a checked exception to help you with the idea of fateful occurrences. So checked exceptions are associated with this idea of fateful or external occurrences or events. The reason it's called checked is because it must be explicitly announced as a possibility. If you have a method that could result in a checked exception, you must indicate that that is the case. An unchecked exception doesn't require that announcement. You can do it if you want. You can actually indicate that a method will throw an unchecked exception, but it's not required. The checked exception is required. Your code will not compile if you don't announce the fact that a checked exception could occur. Exception and all of its ancestors, except for the runtime, if you remember, are checked. Right, that includes I/O exceptions. So all the I/O exceptions are checked exceptions. Runtime and error exceptions are unchecked. Runtime, of course, makes sense because these are things that occur at runtime. And so again, the assumption is something is executing and you have really no control over it, so that makes sense. Error, of course, is for the end of the world kind of issues, which, again, you have no control over. I said that you had to announce that a method could possibly result in a checked exception. How do you do that? You do that through the throws clause, which is part of the exception signature. Well, actually, I probably shouldn't say that. Is associated with the exception signature. It looks like this, the keyword throws followed by a sequence of one or more exceptions separated by commas. A throws clause appears after the method signature, so for example, string read throws IO exception and then the body of the method. The reason these are called exceptions or checked exceptions is a method that propagates an unlisted checked exception causes a compile time error. So for example, if I remove this throws clause and let's assume that read could in fact incur an IO exception, then this code won't compile. I'll get an indication that read could result in a checked exception which isn't listed. I could also, if I wanted to, list unchecked exceptions, but the compiler ignores those. This is a tremendous pain in the neck. Any questions about the throws clause? And now let's go back to your what was your comment about?
You're saying that someone, or you've seen code where it just says throws and then find one.
Right.
Would that just be to circumvent this? The check?
No, because, all right, let's... you have a try block, which does some things, and then you have a finally. If this is in some method, let's say F returns an int, let's assume. And now the question is, do we need to put a throws clause in here? And what's the answer?
No, because we're not expecting an exception.
We're not expecting a... See, now here you have to be careful. We're not expecting a... A checked exception, exactly. If either this code or this code does not throw a checked exception, then we don't need a throws clause here. And let's assume that this is the only code in the body and there's no other code, so we don't have to worry about other codes throwing checked exceptions. Now, suppose that this code does throw a checked exception, either one of those. You would have to do one of two things. The first thing you can do is you could actually catch it. So in here, you could stick a catch clause. Let's just go with IO exception. All right, so if the body of the try statement throws an IO exception, which is, as we saw, is a checked exception, then that will be caught here. Now we have to make a few more assumptions too. So that says, oh great, now I don't have to put throws in there. Except that we need a few more assumptions. And what are those? Exactly. First of all, the catch body cannot throw any IO exceptions. Because if it did throw an IO exception, then that would propagate out of F, and I'd have to indicate throws IO exception here. That's one assumption. Another assumption?
It is, in fact, IO exception.
Well, let's assume that. Let's assume that. Because, yeah, there's all kinds of checked exceptions you could throw. And you know, I suppose we could deal with that by just declaring. So how would I deal with that? Did I talk about that?
Deal with all kinds of stuff?
Right.
You just have to catch an exception?
Right. So it will be throw exception here. And so that takes care of all the checked exceptions under the exception root. Now, I could still get into trouble. How is that? See, this is why exceptions are such fun. This still could possibly not compile. Why is that? Right, and what were those other pieces of the hierarchy? Sorry?
I remember error was one of them.
Error, right, but that's an unchecked exception. So we need another checked exception that wasn't under the exception root in the hierarchy. And what was that? Throwable, exactly. So one of these bodies here could actually throw a throwable, in which case this won't work because a throwable is not assignable to an exception because this is a descendant of throwable. And it would have to be the other way around. So the way to just get rid of all of this is just say throws throwable. And of course that will give all Java programmers a frowny face. Because this is the most general exception, and you essentially you're saying absolutely nothing about the kinds of checked exceptions you would expect to get out of this thing. All right, so let's go back to the IO exception. Oh, yeah. So are we okay here? I guess Jansen brought up, well, we could be throwing a throwable or something like that, but let's assume that we're just throwing IO exceptions here. Will this compile? Or let me put it the other way. If this does not compile, how does it fail? Well, you've seen the pattern. Just apply it. Just keep applying it. Exactly. Finally could throw something, too. Finally could throw an IO exception. All right, this is what I talked about. What did I talk about? Oh, sticky statics, if you remember. When I said that, you know, if you're writing these little Java programs, you have static, public, int, what is it, main, right? And then from within main, you call some method. But that method isn't static, so you get a compilation error because you're trying to call an instance method from a static or a class method, and that's not going to work. So you have to make the method that you're calling also be static. Right, but then that method calls other instance methods, and they have to be made. So it's like the sticky static problem. Well, this is the sticky catches, or sorry, the sticky checked exception problem. Because if any one of these propagates a checked exception, you have to do one of two things. You have to handle that exception, or you have to indicate that it could, in fact, propagate out of this method. Right, so what's the other way to deal with this problem of handling the potential for getting catched or unchecked, sorry, the potential for getting checked exceptions in your code, in your body? One way to do it is this way. There's another way to do it.
Is it handle some other query in that or not?
Handles? I don't think so. No, I'm not familiar with it if it is. All right, so the problem is we could have checked exceptions propagating out of these various bodies. And actually, this is something that we haven't talked about yet, so I guess this is a good point here.
Can't you ignore them?
How?
I don't know, but I think you can in C++. Maybe,
if you catch it and do nothing, that's essentially ignoring error.
Yes, yes. So that's, you're sort of wandering off in the right direction, but...
Just catch throwable, would that work?
No, we want to... Do what? Oh, I see what you're thinking. Yeah, but where would I put that? Where would I put that? That's the question.
The very top of the catches.
So you're saying, let me... So let's put a catch. Exactly. Exactly.
Put all that inside of the try.
There you go. That's the point. And that's the thing that I hadn't mentioned before. These nests, these are statements. A try, catch, finally block is just another statement, which means that you can nest these things. So I can do this. That's why when we were back here, where were we here? It was propagation. Where was it? Did I go back too far? Oh, I thought I had an example of it. Well, anyway... Over here, we had the case where the statements in the try block threw an exception that was not handled by any of the catch clauses. That meant you hit the finally clause, you executed the contents of the finally clause, and then I said you exited the method. Right? And that was wrong. I shouldn't have said that. What I should have said, what I said later was, you propagate the exception. Right? And the difference between those two things is right here. Right, so let's look at this example. Again, the body throws an exception that doesn't get handled in the catch, which means we execute the finally and then propagate the exception, which means what? That exception occurred within the body of another try block, which means that we immediately exit from the outer try block body and then go through the catch list down here. All right, so in this case, the exception has not yet propagated outside the method, because in fact it may be handled by the outer clauses in the clauses in the outer try catch block. If that's not the case, then it will in fact propagate out and I'd have to declare it up here. But the point is, we can announce down here the exceptions that are thrown particularly and finally catch those again down here. And that way, can we get rid of the throws clause?
Possibly.
That's the answer. That's the correct answer. Now, why is that the correct answer?
Because that catch makes something.
Exactly. The problem here is that I could throw yet another exception in the body of this catch clause, or if I have a final clause here too, finally clause. What do you have to do in order to know that that can't be the case?
Look for a throwable, and then just do something.
Sharpen that up. What do you mean, look? Where do I look for this throwable? Where do I look for this? I mean, how do I do this?
On the outside catch block, or try catch.
No, so the issue here is, can this throw a checked exception? Because if it can throw a checked exception, I have to put the throws clause back. So the question is, how do I know whether or not this can actually throw a checked exception?
doesn't do anything? Like, I mean, if it doesn't do anything, then you can't.
Well, yeah, but then that's true. So this could be empty. All right. So this could be a null body. So that's one way to do it. But what I'm trying to get at is the difficulty of understanding how to deal with exceptions. Why this is such a pain in the neck. What you have to do is you have to look at every statement in this body and determine whether or not it can result in a checked exception. All right? And if it can, then you have to do one of two things. You have to wrap this try-catch block in another try-catch block and then catch that checked exception or list it up here as being propagated out of this method.
Can you put try-catch blocks in a catch?
Yes, you can do that too.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm not quite... Maybe, what are you talking about?
Inside the body of the catch, you put a...
Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, yes, certainly. It's just another statement. So you can certainly do that. So you see how these things are multiplying. There's a very tight wheel of reincarnation here. The other point is that this only applies to checked exceptions. You have a similar problem with the unchecked ones. Now, the point behind unchecked exceptions is they're somehow related to these abnormal or external occurrences. So in that sense, you are absolved from responsibility. But that really doesn't help you because you still have to do resource management, right? If I open a file up here, I want to make sure it gets closed down here, independent of whether or not an unchecked or a checked exception comes in. All right, so this division between fateful and, what was it, accidental? See, I've even forgotten what it was. Avoidable. This distinction between fateful and avoidable, to a certain extent, isn't helpful because if I have resources that I need to manage under the possibility of termination via exception, then it's a little comfort to me.
You also have, like, six scopes there.
Yes, exactly. That's the other thing. I guess the first thing to take away from this is at this point we can put the F word in, don't F with exceptions. Right? Just do the simplest possible thing. Because if you try to, you're going to end up with stuff like this. It's just not, and you can't win because you keep opening up the possibility that you're going to incur checked or unchecked exceptions. So it's like I said, it's a very tight wheel of reincarnation. You just keep going around and around. Did that answer the question? Was there a question that this was? So that answer the question, or? No. The other reason I've seen for that, related to what you said, is just, you know, you open a file and you read until you hit a word or you read until you hit the end of file or you do something like that. And what you'd like to do is, independent of whatever the reason is you terminate the reading, you would still like to close the file in clean up state. So by putting everything in a try finally block, then you can do the return here in the body of the try and then have the close in the body of the finally. And regardless of how you exit from here, you're going to close the file. So when I've seen that kind of code, it's usually to do something like that. You have multiple potential exits from a method, and on each one of those exits, you need to do the same thing, usually state management. So you put the state management in a finally, and then you put everything else in the body of a try so that however you exit the method, you will always exit the, you will always execute the resource management code in the finally. So that has nothing to do with exceptions, which I guess means it's bad programming, but I don't... I have not had much experience. I, generally speaking, don't use exceptions at all, so... All right, so that's avoidable versus faithful. I think I backed up from there. Handling occurrences. There is no good excuse for encountering avoidable occurrences, which is why they're avoidable. You should avoid them. There's no good protection against encountering a fateful occurrence. Right, that's the cost-benefit analysis. Exceptions and all its ancestors are checked. Runtime and error exceptions are unchecked. And then the throws clause. All right, any questions about the throws clause. So now we've essentially dealt with the complete issues associated with methods. We know what to do in a body. We now know what to do in a signature. Questions about that? All right, I've introduced a new feature. Now we have to go back and see how our new feature interacts with all our old features. In particular, what's the relationship between inheritance and the throws clause? Now, why is this question interesting? Why do we have to worry about this? Okay, that's true. That's true. Can you make it a little bit more concrete?
It's expecting a certain exception or a certain amount of exceptions.
Right. Essentially what we've done is we've taken our method signature, which is the basis for dealing with inheritance, right? We compare method signatures parent to child, and if there's a match, then we're doing overriding. Okay. And now I've added a new feature. I bolted a new feature onto it. I have this throws clause on the end. So the question is, if I have a method with a throws clause, what does that do to this issue of determining whether or not I'm overriding a parent method? All right, and in particular, if the child method has a throws clause associated with it, what do I need to see in the parent to determine whether or not I'm doing overriding? Right, that's the issue that we're talking about here. A child method overriding a parent method cannot throw more exceptions than the parent method does. It can throw as many or it can throw fewer than, but it can't throw more. What's the rationale behind that? What's the justification? So the example here would be if in the parent, I have a parent method that throws red and white exceptions. In the child, I have exactly the same signature, except that the child only throws red exception. Now the question is this child method, child.f, an override of parent.f, or is this a completely separate method? That's the question we have to deal with. We've introduced a new feature into the signature of methods, so now we have to answer those questions. So what's the answer here? Sorry? Yes, it would be an override, and the justification here?
It throws less exceptions and the same exception.
Right. It throws a subset of the exceptions that the parent throws. Right. If I had done this, the child.f throws red and blue exceptions.
No, unless blue is a child of...
We'll come back to that in a minute. But let's just say no, and your justification for that is?
Blue wasn't thrown by the parent.
Exactly. The set of exceptions thrown by f.child is not a subset of the set of exceptions thrown by, child.f. The set of exceptions thrown by parent.f, let me try this again. Child.f does not throw a subset of the exceptions thrown by parent.f. Except for one possibility, which we'll get to in a minute. Oh, see, now except is overload. Now I have to think of a word other. And, of course, I could do this. What about that? Justify that? Right. The empty set is a subset of the set of exceptions thrown by parent.f. So that's perfectly acceptable. Was there something else I wanted to say here? No, I guess not. Now, let's see, do I mention this? Yeah, all right, so let me just go on, because we have more. That is the sort of subset point of view about whether or not two throws clauses match. There is actually, it's a little bit more complicated, as Jordan indicated. The child exception types thrown must be descendants of the parent's exception types, and this includes the parent's exception types itself. All right, so, in fact, when I ask this question, the proper response is, we don't have enough information because I don't know what the provenance of these exceptions are. Okay? Because, for example, we could say something like this, exception. Now the question becomes, and you know, actually, I'm going to make a mistake, and I'm going to ask a question to which I'm not really sure of the answer. Now, what's the relationship between these two? Parent.f throws the set color. Child.f throws the set red and white. Based on the idea of a subset, this clearly is not an override. These are two different methods. But the tricky part is what? Exactly. Both of these are descendants of color. So the question is this really a, is this, or is this not a subset? Because if we look at this just in terms of these classes, then it's not a subset. But if we look at it in terms of the hierarchy, it is a subset. Both of these are subsets of color. And I don't know the answer to that. And I guess I can assign it as homework. Go figure it out. Write the code and figure it out. Because we have to get going here. On the other hand, we're not going to finish today, so. The third part, which is the really complicated part, the throws clause does not take part in determining the override, which sounds kind of strange. But essentially what that means is when you determine whether or not one method overrides another in a parent and a child or a descendant and a ancestor, you ignore the throws clause and do the match. All right. If that match goes through, then you look at the throws clause to determine whether that match is legal or not. So in a sense, the question of whether or not this throws clause matches this throws clause is kind of irrelevant in determining whether or not you're doing an override, because you don't look at those when you determine whether you have an override. It's only whether that override is legal that you start looking at the throws clauses. That's kind of a subtle point, but it's actually an important one. Questions about that? Here's an example. Red exception extends exception. Blue exception, maybe I answered the question. Blue exception extends exception. So in class P, Moo throws red exception. In class C1, Moo throws red exception and blue exception. Right, well, this fails because, now this is a good overload, right? Because the parameter types and names match. Number matches. So this is an overload. Now the question is it a valid overload? And to answer that, we look at the throws clauses, and it's not, because this is not a subset of that. C2, Moo throws exception. Now, is exception, and again, this is a valid override, so the question is this a subset of that? Okay, justify that? Your answer, you're saying no, so justify that? Right. Exception is not a descendant of red exception, but is an ancestor. So it's not assignment compatible. C3 extends P. This is legal because the empty set is a subset of red exception. Now we come to controversial parts of whether or not how you should deal with exceptions. And let me just go through this. So javadoc and exceptions. You should list exceptions in javadoc with the @throws tag. You should always list checked exceptions in javadoc as well as in throws clauses. You should document unchecked exceptions only in javadoc. So in other words, don't put them in the throws clauses, but put them in javadoc. Throws clauses are actually scary, right, because they imply responsibility, which is why you don't want to junk up the throws clause with unchecked exceptions, because I don't really have to deal with unchecked exceptions. I do have to deal with checked ones, and I want those clearly indicated because those are the things that are going to cause me pain. Big throws classes are even scarier, and unnecessarily big throws classes are annoying. So you want to keep your throws classes as small as you can, and you can do that by essentially limiting them to the checked exceptions, which is what you have to do. Now, I should say that I went out looking for to see what the most recent thinking was on this issue. And I saw all kinds of recommendations, which you can find by essentially Googling for javadoc ampersand throws. A lot of people said don't document unchecked exceptions at all, not even in javadoc. And a lot of people said don't even list checked exceptions in javadoc. And they didn't actually give reasons for that, and so I don't really understand what their thinking was behind that. But I'll just point out that there are lots of different ways to think about the issue of documenting exceptions in javadoc, apparently. In this case, my opinion is that you should err on the side of providing too much documentation rather than not enough. But you should keep in mind that other people might be opinionated in a different direction. So just experiment and see which one works best for you. Defining exceptions. Reasonably involved packages should define an exception set if applicable. If you're doing something fairly complicated, then you probably want to have some way of indicating error returns, and because of the relatively poor way in which you can return values in Java, that may unfortunately involve using exceptions. Classes that have their own exception set are probably too big. Packages have lots of classes, and presumably all those classes work together to provide some service. That service may have exceptions. You should not have individual classes that have their own exception sets. Right, that suggests possibly, that's possibly a code smell, which suggests that your class is doing too much and it's too big. Extend the most distant ancestor of exception that seems appropriate. This is just a general rule of thumb. You want to, and essentially what is this saying? The idea that you should be as far away from exception as you can when you define your new exceptions. What is that essentially indicating? Okay, but tell me what the idea of top-down versus bottom-up means. I mean, what's the issue there?
If you're extending the child, like the further down child,
right?
When you handle the exception, you would be starting with that. Like you'd be dealing with the child, so you wouldn't have ever get like below that. Like, I don't know how to say that. If you have a class parent and then you extend it with class child, and that is like the lowest answer.
All right, what is that? All right, let's stop there. What does that mean when you say I have a parent and I extend it with class child? What are you doing?
Inheritance.
Right, but why are you doing that? What's the point there? You're making it more specific. Right? When you have a parent class and you say, oh, I need to make a child, that parent class is not specific enough. So you create a child that adds more detail. The issue here, the point here, is that by going down as far away from exception as you can, you are going to more and more specific exceptions. So the point here is you should throw specific exceptions. You shouldn't just throw, ooh, runtime error. Right, you should throw a specific exception. You want to give as much information as you can back to whoever is going to handle that exception. So the idea of driving down as far as you can into the hierarchy means you should be sending the most specific exceptions you can. That's the point here. Exception defining tips. Don't gratuitously define your own exceptions. If there's an exception already there in the list, then you can look at the API docs to see the complete list. Use that. Illegal argument exception or unsupported operation exception, right? Those are already there, so don't redefine them. Go easy on the checked exceptions. They are a fairly significant requirement. They have to be handled or thrown, announced, by every method that could possibly incur one. So that's a fairly sizable responsibility, and as we indicated over here with this example, it's a sticky one too. But on the other hand, don't freak on the taxonomy. It's like, you could spend a lot of time putting an exception over here versus putting it over there. If you find yourself moving an exception too many times, you're probably worrying too much about it. Related to what I just said, define leaf exceptions for throwing. So you should always throw leaf exceptions. And parent exceptions are for extending. Right, so if you're writing a library that, for example, does, I don't know, class file manipulations, you may have a parent exception that is malformed bytecode. Right, that would be a parent exception, and then under that you would have individual leaf exceptions that you would throw when, for example, the constant pool has been corrupted, or specific examples like that. Exceptional exceptions. As I've attempted to argue throughout this lecture, exceptions are expensive and obscure. Unwinding the stack is disruptive. Exceptions start down there in that library all the way down there, and then they wind through here, and then they go up there. All right? Exceptions should mark rare, unusual, and significant events. That's the point here. This is controversial, however. Avoid using exceptions for run-of-the-mill control and communication is the point I'm trying to get across here. Now, there are people who would argue the opposite. They would say, oh, there's no problem using exceptions for run-of-the-mill control and communications. And in fact, that red book I held up at the beginning of the semester, Liskov and Guttag's book on program development in Java, they recommend using exceptions in ways which I completely disagree with. I have an example right here. I've seen people write code like this. You want to go through an array, presumably processing every element of the array, and the question is, when should you stop? Well, you should stop when there are no more elements. How do you figure that out? Well, normally you go from 0 to array length minus 1. Right? Well, the alternative is to just march through the array element by element until you run off the end of the array and hit an index error exception. I forget what it's, index out of bounds exception. Right? That would be caught, and then you'd exit out. Right, this is an example of run-of-the-mill control flow. Right? You go through every element of the array and stop. This, in my opinion, is an example of very bad programming in Java and C++. On the other hand, Liskov and Guttag seem to feel that this is fine. It's up to you to figure out whether or not this is good or bad. My arguments are loops are optimized. People spend 30, 40, 50 years trying to figure out how to optimize loop code. On the other hand, exceptions are not. They are something that is expected not to occur very often, so they don't really have to be optimized. Another problem is that F's exceptions are masked, right? Any exceptions that F throws are also going to be caught here, which is probably not what you want, which means that you're going to have to refine this. You're going to have to make it more complicated. In addition, selective catch clauses don't help. Control is quickly obscured with more code. This is a really simple example, but if I start putting like 5 lines above and 5 lines below, now the question is, what's happening here? What's going on? However, as I indicated, some people thoughtfully or perhaps less thoughtfully disagree. At this point, we're out of time. So that's it. Have a wonderful spring break, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.